And we're talking about moral issues in medicine. Last week we had three conferences in this on genetics, abortion, and the money matters of medicine. And this week we're going to talk about death and dying today, and tomorrow about organ transplantation, on Friday about human experimentation. I even bring my props sometimes for visual things. Happened to find that upstairs, sir, so we hauled it down, thought it fitted in right with what we're going to talk about today. There's been a lot of things written and in the newspapers these days about the subject of death and dying. This is a problem that this generation and future generations are going to be facing more and more as the increasing technology of medicine presents this problem to us of maintaining life and discerning where life really ends. Early generations were not faced with this problem because they didn't have the technology to prolong the life. And the problems that they faced was humanizing the death experience. And we've somehow forgotten that whole experience and that whole feeling, and up until the last few years didn't even want to talk about the subject of death. One man wrote about this, saying that this was a pornography of the death thing. He said that earlier generations held things sexual to be unmentionable, but spoke openly about death and about the dying process. And he contrasts that with today, with our playwrights and our TV and our mass media, who've replaced the deathbed with the bedroom scene and blown that completely out of proportion and tried to suppress the deathbed scene. One of the problems that there's been a lot of publicity about is defining when does death really occur. This has come along, of course, with the whole abortion issue also. There are some people who feel that life begins when all of the genetic material is present there to determine that life. These same people then perhaps feel that as long as that genetic material is still intact, that life must be present. And so this is a problem. More and more we're coming down to a legal definition of death, which is in some ways a help to the doctor and also a hindrance to it. We have a clinical definition of death in that when the heart ceases to function on its own or a patient ceases to breathe on his own, he's clinically dead. However, we also have to have some people who are concerned about whether his brain may still be functioning or not in that process. And so a lot of our legalistic attempts at defining death have really tied it in to whether a person still has brain function or not. It's probably because of the fact that we can support the heart and continue the heart pacing, we can continue the person breathing with all of our modern technology, but we have not at this point arrived at the point where we can continue the brain to function. And so they're saying that when the brain is no longer functioning, then the person really is dead. If we look at death and dying, the doctor has a lot of options this point in a person's life. We can continue life at all costs. And there's been a lot written about that, mostly in the horror of keeping people alive on the machines and not letting perhaps what God intended to take place for that person. There's another option. This is called passive euthanasia, which basically translates to cooperating with the dying process. The third option is that of active euthanasia, or actively ending life's processes at a time when society or when people feel that it should be terminated. I hope that in the discussion we can get into each one of these areas and talk about them. One of the medical legal things which is going around the legislatures nowadays is the thing of called the living will. And I don't know if you've heard of the living will or not. We recently had legislation passed this year in Washington making this a legal entity. Speaking as a physician, I will have some hesitancy about the living will until it's actually been tested in the courts in our state. But it is, in fact, a law which was recently passed by our legislature. Basically, a living will is when a person in supposedly his right mind signs proper documents with his lawyer and gives a copy of this document also to his doctor, and one copy is retained with his legal will. Simply stating that if he has an accident or any kind of an illness which would leave him with a very poor quality of life, with no reasonable expectation of being restored to his former good health, then he would prefer that no heroic measures be taken to maintain a life. You can also add into this particular document a wish to donate various organs for use in transplantation and sustaining and improving the quality of other person's life as part of the living will. Many of us have heard a lot about Kubler-Ross and her writings on death and life after death, and I hope that maybe we can talk a little bit about that. One of the other concepts that is presently on the rise across America is the concept of the hospice now. If you don't know what the hospice is, a hospice is basically a facility for taking care of people who are terminally ill. They're not, the whole care there is not given to prolonging life or performing heroic measures of saving that life, but the concept is one of closeness and supporting the person during that period of time when their life is ending. No life prolonging measures are employed there. It's simply a matter of closeness, of meeting all of their needs during their last days. Before we start the discussion, I'd like to read a little bit here. I'm using from Human Medicine here, Moral Issues in Medicine. That's put out by Augsburg Press here. He closes that chapter on death and dying by saying, "In the final analysis, our attitudes about death and dying profoundly affect our attitudes about life and living. As Christians, we are called to celebrate and treasure personal life without at the same time slipping into a biological idolatry which fearfully demands life at any price. By coming to grips with the inevitability of our own deaths, we are better able to consecrate life and to be authentically available to the needs of the dying. Death is not the final enemy for those who have convinced, who are convinced that whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord." So from that closing thing, let's kind of open up the floor now and talk a little bit about death and dying. There were some pastors that had talked to me earlier in the week and said that they would like to, that they were beginning to work in this particular area and would like to add something to it, and I invite some of the pastors to add anything they'd like to.
I'm sure we have many widows here in our circle today that probably could tell us a lot about death and dying and how they themselves came through that experience. Especially the experience of guilt,
mm-hmm.
Feeling guilty that you didn't do enough or did too much. Maybe there's some widows who could give us some insight into how to deal with the fact of death.
There are others of us here who have experienced death that are not widows,
yes,
through the death of children,
yes,
which is much harder to take than the death of a spouse, which I've experienced both.
I feel this is sort of aside from our topic. This living will, I signed this little thing, but I didn't go through a lawyer in that you mentioned it. I got it through an education company. Perhaps some of the Lutherans may have read in the Lutheran Standard a few years ago, has science become God?
Mm-hmm.
But this is, I feel very happy about this. I'd rather have my last money spent for a child, that we could save the life of a child rather than myself.
I hope that what you intended when you signed that card will take place for you. But unfortunately, I can't guarantee that it will, because it all depends on medical legal matters that take place at the time when you die.
Of course, it relieves my family of making the decision, or the doctor making the decision, whether I wish to be kept alive on life-saving machines or not.
But I've been faced with the problem of a person who signed such a document, and at the time when they were terminally ill and in a coma, their sons or daughters objecting to not doing heroic care for their, and the physician is put in the place of wanting to follow what the living will or this particular document says for him to do, but also facing the problem that he can be charged with a criminal thing if he does withhold treatment.
Of course, that gets into euthanasia again. That isn't.
No, it's not the problem of euthanasia.
I mean, this really isn't. My family witnesses. They signed it as witnesses.
If you have the signature of your family, would that relieve you?
Well, I think it would.
As a physician,
yes.
I mean.
I think that the nice thing about the living will is, first of all, we need to all contemplate our death, okay?
Yes.
And go through that necessary mental exercise. And then I think it tells us to talk with our family about how we want matters handled at the time of our death. Okay.
As far as giving the organs concerned, you mentioned that too.
Mm-hmm.
But at my age, they said, pretty well used up.
What is the age when they stop wanting your organs?
Close to 70.
We had deeded our bodies to the University of Iowa Medical mm-hmm. Hospital. And we asked them, I told them too, I said, there isn't too much of me left. They took out this, and they took out that, and they took out something else. And he said, well, that's all right. Dr. Bill Reiki, incidentally, was the one who helped us fill out our business, you know. I mean,
appeal you.
And appeal you now.
Yeah.
And he said, it doesn't make a difference. He said, whatever is left, we still use to teach. He said, one of our old professors here came in one day, and he said, well, I'm ready to deed my body. He said, I've taught in the medical school for I don't know how many decades, and he said, this way I can go on teaching one more year. I thought this was a very commendable attitude, really. And my 97 cents worth of what my body is worth when the soul is gone, if it can serve some purpose, that's what I want to do. But he urged us not to give our heart to one place and our liver to another place and our skin to some other place. He said, let us have your body intact as much as possible. And we'd already signed Lions Club eye donor cards, and all of our children have. And he said, that's all right, the eye department will get your eyes anyway, even if we have all the rest of you. So, and our children were all aware that we did this, and we each of our children has a copy of this, so they know what's going to happen when we die. But we'd had four deaths in the family within about 3 years, and if you'll pardon the expression, we'd had funerals. So we weren't going to have any more, and we just thought this was a sensible thing to do.
But you still have a funeral. You're not cosmetology affected at all through these giving these organs.
No, but you give your whole body, you give it within 40 minutes.
What concerns me is the great distance between what people will say they want their death to be and what really does occur. And I've seen it time and time again where a person has stated before their illness how they wanted to end their life. And at the last minute, the family or the doctor or some kind of influence has come through that is not coming of age.
Yes, I see that all the time too, and this is what concerns me, really. Let me tell you from the standpoint of a physician, when, let's say, a determination is made that a person, for instance, is terminal in terms of dying from some kind of disease or as a relation to some kind of accident, at that particular point, all physicians usually go to the family and look for the direction from the family. And if you happen to be part of the family, I've been caught in the situation of being whipsawed between the daughter and the son and this kind of thing. One wants one thing, one wants another thing, you see. And so don't blame the physician for not wanting to put his neck in the legal noose. Because if he withholds heroic treatment on one thing, he can be charged legally if death does occur at this particular as a result of his withholding. And so he is caught in between. If the family has a difference in how they feel death should be handled or what treatment should be handled, the family should work that out. And usually what I try to do is I try to get the family all together and explain everything that's wrong and why I feel that things are terminal and why I don't feel that there's any possibility of restoring a quality of life that they would probably want. And then let the family take all the facts and sit down together and discuss how they want it handled from that particular point. And then if you're in that family situation and you appoint somebody as being the person who will relate with the doctor and give the information that the family wants given to the doctor, then it makes it a lot easier and things are likely to happen along the way that the family wants them to go. But again, as the point she made, that may not necessarily be what the person who's dying really wanted to happen. And this is what the whole purpose of the living will concept is, and until it's been tried in the courts several times, it probably will not function as we had hoped it would. There was a...
When we were in the Bible study, he talked about being shaky, and it asked us when we were shaky, and we said it's when we were near death. And it seems as though the time that you were told that your mother or father was dying, you would be shaky, and probably at that time wouldn't be unable to make a very good decision. So it seems to me the message then from you would be to sit down, like you said, and do it before.
If possible, yes.
And then have the papers signed by the whole family.
Right.
But I think it has to be done on legal channels because the family will change their mind.
Yeah.
And if it is not legal, the family needs to be bound by legal ways also. You know, I mean, I know
yeah,
that
I
when,
understand what you mean.
You know, if my parents said, no, this is how they want to die, and when I came to deal with that question, it is such a big question, it would be so painful to me that I might be tempted to say, I changed my mind. I want them to live as long as possible. And I think that we need to have some legal boundary, legal binding, so that I could not change my mind if my parents had made that decision.
Then well, that would bring up the guilt issue again, I suppose.
Is there a difference here? Is there a difference whether it's handled through a lawyer or just within the family signing a paper as far as you are concerned with the doctor?
I would say as a doctor, I would feel much more comfortable if it was a legal paper. Because then, you see, that would make the lawyer responsible for researching the legal processes within that state to make sure that the letter of the law had been met. If the family changed their mind at a later time and there was just a family document, then you would find the doctor really on shaky ground to try and follow what a majority of the family recommends or what this document says and what perhaps one other individual who changed their mind recommended.
Well then from a doctor's point of view, you would be more apt to go with the heroic measures because the living people would sue you rather than...
That's right. Does anybody feel that as doctors we should be totally following a concept of doing everything possible to keep any alive?
No way. No.
Is there time then that when we can withhold treatment morally and allow passive euthanasia to take place?
Yes. I had an experience with my father-in-law. I had taken care of him. He had a stroke and was in a very bad situation. And the doctor came and said, now your father-in-law is going to die in a matter of days. Now, he said, if you wanted him taken to the hospital, I bow out. You'll have to get another doctor. Because I think the best thing is for him to just pass out quietly. So it was our decision to do this. But he himself bowed out of the situation.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most horrible things about dying nowadays is people are dying in hospitals and nursing homes instead of at home.
That's what I felt when my father died.
Mm-hmm. Medicine is trying to move to allow or to provide the services that will allow people to die at home. And in terms of we have visiting nurses and supportive people who will come into your homes and help you take care of the dying person within your home. And I think that's a tremendous movement, because I know I'd rather die at home than die in a hospital surrounded with all of the strange things.
Well, this doctor's liability insurance, I think it's just...
As a physician, how sure can you feel about a person's personal, their own closeness to death or the irreparability of it? And to what extent is that a judgment that you make? How do you go about making that kind of determination?
Most of the time it's not. I can't predict the day and the time and say that... that he has a week and 10 days or something like that. But I can tell that in the very near future, things are likely to happen. Now, you know, if a terminal person, a person who is in terminal health comes into the hospital, for instance, we can determine how much we have to do to support their vital signs, how long they're likely to live, you see. And this is one of the big issues that we are faced with as physicians. How much should we do to support life once that patient is brought to hospital, you know? If they're already in a coma, and if their heart is failing, and their lungs are filling up with fluid, and their kidneys have stopped functioning completely, we look to the family. Should we ever put them on the pump and start them breathing? Should we put them on a kidney dialysis machine and start cleaning their blood for them, you know? Should we put in a pacemaker and start driving their heart? These are all key decisions that we have to make once we've determined that they are in the terminal state. And the problem is, once you get these life support functions started, then it's very hard to withdraw them and take the person off and let them die.
I think it's unfortunate that we're all rather selfish, and that when one of our loved ones is dying, we want to satisfy our needs rather than theirs. And that's why we want to keep them. Mm-hmm. When in fact they have the right to die just as much as they have the right to live.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it all come down to our attitude about death? It seems if you're a Christian, that ought to be the best part of your life, because that's the promise that we've been living for all this time we've been down here. And maybe you're right, maybe it's just selfishness, but it seems like our attitude about death is just absolutely reversed to what it ought to be. It ought to be a celebration for that person who is a Christian and going home, rather than a funeral dirge like it usually is. I've experienced deaths of children, but not somebody that I've lived with for a long time. And so, you know, I know that I'm at an age where it doesn't seem like it's right on me. I think it's really hard that you don't have that person with you, but it still seems to me that Christians need to look at their ideas about death and wonder why they're so miserable over it.
What if the person who is dying, though, is not a Christian?
That is a different story. Yeah. I have,
yeah. I think also the issue of dying too often comes up when something suddenly happens. I think it seems to me that it's easier to accept death if it's slow in coming, if someone's had a terminal disease. But you take a 18-year-old boy who's gotten an accident and has a severe head injury and is in deep coma and extensive brain damage. The family is just taking such a shock that you just can't all of a sudden say, well, okay, this terminal situation, go ahead and don't do hard for parents to do this, and I can understand it. So there has to be a period of time where they have to comprehend this incredible thing that happened. And usually they'll say, we shouldn't have done anything.
Is there ever a time for active euthanasia? I can give you an example of a patient who had had a number of strokes and had been successfully rehabilitated from several of them so that he could return home and live a reasonable life. But then he had an especially severe one which knocked out his ability to speak and left him with almost no ability to use his arms and legs. But the one thing he could do was lay there and scream and look like he was in pain. And he did that for 5 years in a nursing home. And it drove me crazy. It drove the people who had to take care of him crazy. But he lived for 5 years that way.
I think that comes out of your really moral issue, because if you can do active or anything, you can, you know, people with little babies who are really mentally retarded, they might say, well, we don't want this baby anymore, so, you know, let it die. And I don't know, I don't trust man to, I don't know, man has really blown it many times through history, and I think he will blow it some more if you just start doing more.
How are you legally affected by active euthanasia? I mean that, because I remember it was probably 30 years ago, there was a case, a doctor in New York, Dr. Sanders, I believe it was, and that we studied that in school, and he was debarred. I mean, you know, no longer could practice for that small time ago. Things are different than that.
I was just reading that in here about that case there and Irving, about what was written about it. Doctors do practice active euthanasia, but they don't admit to it.
Yeah, he admitted it.
Okay, and what we're talking about is the terminally ill patient who is seems to be in a fair amount of pain. A lot of doctors will give them excess amounts of pain medication, supposedly relieving their pain, but really they're also hurrying up the process of dying for that particular individual.
Well, that's really bad, because you can't even trust the doctor. I mean, here's the doctor. You know, I mean,
that's not done just by the doctor on his own. It's done with the concurrence of the family, you know.
But if a patient is mentally alert, you know, did the doctor and family ask the patient to?
And, you know, if the patient is able to make any kind of decision like this, they're always involved in making any kind of decision like this. But the problem is when the patient is no longer has his senses, and therefore you have to rely on the family or legal means to make these decisions, you see.
This actually active euthanasia occurring across the nation in the emergency units with burn patients, and they are brought into they are brought in. These patients are 95, above 90% burned. Well, they are terminal. They just do not survive that kind of an injury. And they are given the choice of whether they will be treated, in which case they will take a week or 2 weeks with incredible pain and incredible life, and then they will finally die. Or they are told, oh, we can give you pain medication and make you comfortable, and then they'll die in a day or two.
That's really passive euthanasia, though. They don't really give them enough to make them die. They just give them enough to make them comfortable so they can tolerate life as long as life is in them.
But the case that she was referring to, that particular doctor injected, there's a terminally ill patient dying of cancer and with a lot of suffering, injected a large quantity of air into his vein.
And this patient was screaming in agony, and the family says, please.
There has never been a conviction in the United States on a mercy killing, whether it was doctor or family. If a person was put out for mercy reasons, they were death was hurried along. I think that says something about our society in a way.
Well, you consider conviction, don't you think Dr. Sanders was convicted?
No, he was not. He was not convicted. The bad thing about it was that the local medical society took away his license to practice medicine for for 5 to 7 years thereafter.
Then why is it wrong to commit suicide if you're terminal?
Because we have laws on
that. Say that again.
Why is it wrong to commit suicide if you're terminal?
Good question.
That is really the question, isn't it? Euthanasia, when does euthanasia become suicide? Self-euthanasia?
It's self-inflicted.
Well, who said suicide is wrong? I read an article just it was in last Sunday's New York Times, I think, of a woman, maybe you saw this, a woman very much promoting this idea that you ought to be able to determine a time when your life ended, and she ended her life with an overdose of something in her own apartment and left an extensive diary and some recordings and some video material that she hoped would be used for a documentary to speak to this problem. So she was trying to enlist other people behind the idea that suicide is a legitimate option. She probably wouldn't want to use that word for it.
She was probably severely depressed, and if the right hand had been held out to her, she could have been helped and perhaps had a good life thereafter. I've seen many, many patients do this. Most of the times, suicide attempts are a cry for help, and we see them all the time, and we deal with them and help these people. You know, and you talk to people who have made a suicide attempt years later, and they thank you for pulling them through and giving them a new direction in their life, and they're happy. But there are those certain few who do make repeated attempts and are finally successful. I agree, but I wouldn't encourage people in suicide because I think it's a not a well thought out answer. A lot of times in a fit of depression.
Depression is quite often a biological imbalance.
That's right.
Well,
that's
the Bible
right.
says people shouldn't take their own lives, so Christians take that into consideration too.
That's the one unforgivable sin.
But if you're terminal, it's easier than
blasphemy.
Blasphemy.
Yeah.
I think
we've
got it.
Did the huzzahs on the unforgivable sin catch? Suicide is not an unforgivable sin.
Do you come up with any miracle healing?
I just like to share a parable on suicide. In a rural parish that I served several years ago, a suicide person was buried many years ago outside the cemetery. Across the, in those days they had a fence around the cemeteries to keep the cattle out, and this particular person was buried outside the fence because of suicide. It's interesting that over the years, as that cemetery expanded, that grave became the center of the cemetery. And I've always thought that was a parable, that the very person that was put outside became the center.
Mm-hmm. Well, this burying them outside of the cemetery got its roots way, way back in the Old Testament, where somebody committed suicide. They were buried outside the camp.
Judas in the field of blood, whatever it was. I thought of this as a parable. Maybe God was trying to say something to that parish.
Mm-hmm. But they should not judge.
Yes, yes.
Well, it wasn't too long ago that a man, 25 years, maybe, a man committed suicide. They wouldn't have his funeral in the church.
That's right.
Which, to me, is dreadful. When does a family need help more than when a member of the family has committed suicide? And who is the church ministering to? The dead person who committed suicide, or the ones who are left to mourn this suicide? And I'm glad the church isn't quite that terrible anymore. It's more human. This Quinlan case, though, she's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
After how many years of being in a coma, and she's living without life support, and there is no hope. But her people have accepted it, and are now. It seems to me the last I read on it are using this as an example of not letting people die. And I don't know whether I agree with it, but
I think the Quinlan case is a good example, though, of where our society is right now at this particular point and why I think we need to move forward with proper legislation. She was brought in a coma and originally placed on the respirator and with these other heroic measures while assessment could be made of what had happened and what the damage was done. Once that assessment was made and it was judged that she was terminal, then the family made the decision to shut off the machines. And I really think that the family made the right decision at that particular time. Unfortunately, the legal community or the medical legal standards at that particular point in that particular state would not support the family making that type of decision. And then it was turned over to the courts, and we know all the horrible things that went on there. And then when the courts finally agreed with what the family had done and they shut off the machine, it didn't do any good.
Do you think she would have died if it had been done sooner?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Collins, could you discuss a little bit the economic aspect of euthanasia? That it might be easier to pull the plugs for a kind of poor person who couldn't pay the hospital and not on the wealthy? Mm-hmm. Or when would it be a temptation for a doctor to prolong life for economic reasons of his own?
Well, that definitely comes in when you're talking about this. As we talked about on a week ago today, the money matters as far as medicine is concerned. I pointed out that over 50% of the money that is spent on welfare medicine is spent for just 4% of the people. And these are the people who because of some particular illness that they have, or because of the fact that they come back repeatedly for heroic care because they refuse to take care of themselves, that they use up a large amount of these economic resources. And I get involved in this process a lot of the time. I think what Marge is saying is something that we all, as physicians, are concerned about. I would say, as a physician, that the question of doing everything that I can for that person never comes up, except in the case of the person who comes back repeatedly, year after, or every so months, with a type of illness that's perhaps related to alcohol intake or drug abuse or some self-destructive type of behavior on themselves. That's the only point where you ever get involved in the question of how many times are we going to continue to do these heroic measures to keep this person alive when they appear to not want to put forth any effort towards maintaining their health or this kind of thing. But it is a problem. And I think the other thing that I've thought about when she first addressed the question is dying is a tremendously costly process in our society nowadays. And it could be so much simpler if it was at home or in the hospice instead of in the hospital or in the nursing homes where it costs a tremendous amount of money.
A while ago, I think you said a hospice is a facility. I've heard doctors emphasize that. But from what I can read and hear other people say, it isn't a facility, but it's a community response to the terminally ill. Can you speak to that?
It's actually a philosophy, which may include having a facility or be home care.
Right.
But it actually is a philosophy of dying.
There's two different models. Yeah. The European model is the facility, as I understand.
Right.
And what's been done in America mostly has been at the home. Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between a hospice and a nursing home?
Oh. A lot's difference.
Yeah.
Let some of those who work with them explain the difference if they can for you. Is there anybody who wants to tackle that question?
No, but there's a lot of difference between nursing homes, too.
Yeah.
Don't you think our nursing homes and small communities are used as sort of a substitute hospice?
Yes, they are, but not very well. One of the other point I want to make before I try to answer her question is that you know that none of your insurances, including your government insurances, will pay for the care that you receive in your hospice or at home during the time of dying. And so this really then, most of us, you know, if our resources are pretty low at that particular point, that means that we have to die in the hospital or in the nursing home rather than these other places where it would perhaps be better. But the difference with a hospice, in a nursing home, now there's retirement homes and there's nursing homes. And maybe we can talk about the concept between that, as I see a difference between a retirement home. A retirement home is for people in their later years to kind of live in somewhat of a sheltered community. That's kind of how I look at that. A nursing home is a place where I feel like we garage or store people who cannot care for themselves or don't have other people, relatives or such, to care for them. And we maintain, we provide a level of care. And this level of care can range from excellent to the really horrible. Now the hospice, on the other hand, is, first of all, you're dealing with people who are terminal. We do know most people who are cared for in a hospice-like situation are probably facing death within the next year. And it's an attempt at maintaining a certain quality of life or supporting that person in a quality of life up to a certain point, and then hopefully death will occur rather rapidly after that certain point is reached. But you're not treating with drugs except maybe to relieve pain. Okay. You're not trying to prolong anything at that particular point. You're trying, as I said again, to maintain quality, and that involves a lot of loving by all of the people and personnel that are around you. People who work in hospices are people who are really giving of themselves to these people as they die, and I think they take a special kind of person to do that.
And how expensive are they?
Mm-hmm. You know, Jim?
No, I don't.
I can't talk about the economics of
them. One of our Lutheran hospitals near us is calling a director of a hospice. Now they're, I think, thinking about either including it in the hospital structure or an adjacent building. Is that, I think, you think, a commendable thing to tie it close to, or does that bring it back into an expensive structure?
Oh, I think it could be a good thing, but I'd rather see it separate from the hospital, because there'll always be that carryover feeling with the hospital structure that close. You're trying to, in the hospice, to get people away from that part, the saving part of life or the treating part of life, and getting into the
Kubler Ross is totally for this too.
What?
Kubler Ross is totally for
right.
Separation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
An order of Catholic sisters in St. Paul for many years have had a home for terminal cancer patients. They didn't, I don't know about their practice now, but they did not charge patients for years. Those who could and wanted to pay, they took people of all religious faiths and races, and did a marvelous job.
I don't think you can find that all over America, though.
There's one in the same order in Cleveland, and you know, it's just marvelous. People die, but they die with a dignity and an understanding.
Even in your cheapest nursing homes nowadays, you're looking at $1,000 a month for just basic care for an individual, and so the costs are going up tremendously.
What she was saying, I think she was referring to the Little Sisters of the Poor. And one of the patients I took care of was an elderly man who refused to have surgery.
and was just literally badgered by his family and some surgeons who wanted to perform surgery. And he chose to die without surgery. And these sisters would come and visit him and would support him in this. They would just stand up to the whole medical profession and say, we are going to stand behind this man. And he died, you know, the way he chose to. It was really a good experience for us, you know, the nurses who we are kind of used to the other way of doing it. It was a really very
I think that's an important point that she's brought out there, which is another trend in medicine nowadays, is that the patient makes all the decisions that they're capable of making. There are still a lot of doctors and people who are uncomfortable with that, but after you present the alternatives and the patient says, I want to go this direction or I want to go that direction, then you have to follow what they want. And you can't be compelled to accept any kind of treatment as long as you're able to make that decision.
Marge and I knew it. The old cosmetologist for Tara Bowe. Some of you recall her name. Famous actress way back 40, 50 years ago. He's an old man, lived right next to us, delightful person. He did Marge up once as Tara Bowe. She couldn't get home fast enough to take it off. He was at St. Joseph's, sixth floor, with tubes in every orifice. You know? One afternoon, he just pulled them all out, put his bathrobe on, down the fire escape, took a taxi home, and of course they couldn't get him back. He lived for a year without tubes.
I wonder if some thought ought to be given to the fact that it appears that the role of government is increasing in the health process. You know, that isn't the bigger issue to wrestle with. But dealing with death is minor, but dealing with the role of government is a tremendous issue.
And the role that government is playing in the economy of death now is, you know, every Time Magazine or U.S. News or whatever has something about somebody's program about will help the families who have terminally ill people or who have tremendous medical expenses. I'd sort of like to know what direction that's going and what the church thinks of this.
Paul?
This, I think, kind of ties into that. And where is the constraint on this whole issue of the insurance and government not paying for a hospice and not paying for home care? That seems to be such an inhuman, not to mention uneconomic, problem. I've had a situation where a parishioner wanted to keep her husband at home and finally did so at great cost to herself.
That's right.
Because she wanted him to die at home. And yet, it seems to me that she would have been doing everybody a favor, the patient, herself, the hospital, the government, the insurance company, and everybody. Where is the constraint on that? Is there anything that, as normal people, we can do to help push along that process?
Talk to your elected representatives is basically the only thing you can do. But
is it mostly governmental? And
yes, it's governmental. They have rules and regulations. And
what is the basis of it? It seems so inane to me that I don't know for sure how to argue against it.
I agree.
One of the comments I heard that the basis for that is that insurance, medical insurance, hospital insurance, is to pay for helping people get well. And the philosophy is that the medical insurance is not to help people die, but to cure them, not to keep helping them.
But if we looked at the economics of it, the people that were keeping in the hospital and allowing them to die at the tremendous cost to society, we could easily pay for a lot more people to be cared for at home while they die.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, you have to convince them of that. And in the meantime, it might be well for everybody to have catastrophic illness insurance, because we have seen families wipe out.
That's right.
And, you know, how long does it take to run a bill of $70,000 if you're on all-time life-saving?
Blue Cross in Indiana says that they're beginning to move in the direction. I think some people are covered now in hospice. I just came from a conference in which the head of the Blue Cross was discussing it. He says the nursing care is twice as many hours.
That's right.
But the overall cost is about half, letting a person die in hospice or in the hospital.
I think for years insurance companies have had clauses in their policies saying that a patient cannot even be treated by a relative, whether that relative be a nurse or a doctor and so forth, and still get paid off, and the insurance company's paid off. And I think the basis of this is they're concerned about fraud, mm-hmm. about people taking people into their home and getting paid for years, mm-hmm. and knowing there's no way out. So I think that's the problem of getting it changed over. It's not only government, but it's also the insurance company's concerned with fraud.
I think that, you know, we're kind of putting it on to somebody else, because I think it's our responsibility. We are the government, and we are the ones who can help. And finally, well, I just couldn't handle it anymore, and it's cheaper, and it's. And I think that, you know, I think our attitude about death and caring for the elderly and all that has to be changed, and I feel that the church is the place that is an excellent beginning, whereas we're supposed to be the loving community. And so often in those nursing homes, the love is just all gone from the family and from the, certainly the attendants. And
getting back into some of the economic issues, right now Senator Long's bill presently talks about giving care for catastrophe illnesses. Any medical illness which costs more than $2,000 in 1 year's time would be covered completely by this catastrophe insurance after that point. And that $2,000, of course, if you carried another insurance that covered that, then you would have no cost at that. But also, I think another important part of the bill is that it sets standards for insurance, for health insurance. And I don't know per se that it covers hospice care as part of that, but I think that this is an area where you can influence legislation, you know, and telling people and striving for this kind of thing. The other thing I wanted to tell you was that we've had a crisis in the state of Washington the last 6 months with less and less nursing home beds being available for Medicare and Medicaid patients. And the reasoning, the reason for this is the government has all of these standards for nursing homes. You must have so many people for every resident, and you must follow all of these guidelines, you must crank out all of this paper, but they don't want to pay for it. And like welfare in this state pays $16 per day per patient. And if you look at the economics of the nursing home, they just can't make it. They can't, it's, you know.
Mark, and how can you stop this? We're very closely associated with the Home for the Aged in our town, which offers three types of care. One is for the ambulatory people, they live on one floor, and the ones who are vegetables, if you want to call them that, and then the ones who are, you know, just nursing care. And, you know, they have to have so much dining room space for the people who haven't been out of their beds for 3 months. Mm-hmm. And this is ridiculous. And the administrator there and the board, they hassle with this all the time. Why should they have to have dining room space for, say, 35 people who haven't been fed other than intravenously? What is the common sense of that? I don't understand, and we don't know how to fight it. We write to our representatives. We have a senator who lives just within 20 miles, and we talk with him all the time. He says, my hands are tied. Well, what do you do?
In the city of Spokane, because there are no beds available in any nursing homes for this kind of people, we're sending them to all the communities around. They go 50, 60, 70 miles from Spokane to place these people in nursing homes. Can you imagine what that does to the family? Mm-hmm. Your husband is shipped 70 miles out to be put away in a nursing home, and you have no way of ever getting there to visit him or do anything, and we face this all the time.
So bad that in the home that belongs to 50 of our churches in Orange County, Southern California, the home is losing $360,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Our congregation has to pay $10,000 a year for the next 3 years, $8,000 the next three, and so on, just to pick up the tab now on what Uncle Sam does not provide. And that's frightening.
Marge mentioned a little while ago that health insurance is designed for people to become well. And that brings to mind for me the business of the medical community dealing with death, dying, I'd like to hear you address that a little bit, and like the business of a doctor telling a patient that he or she is terminally ill, or that whole process.
Good.
I'd like to hear some talk about that.
There was some study of this issue done back in the early 1970s, and the questionnaire went out to hundreds of physicians, and came. The question was posed, how many of your patients, when you discover that they are terminally ill with cancer, do you tell that? And it was really a shock when it came back that only about 30% felt, the doctors said only about 30% of patients they felt were capable of understanding that. And since Kubler-Ross and the whole issue has been brought up, that's gone up tremendously. And in my experience, it's only a very isolated patient that we ever don't tell that they're terminal. And only, again, after conferring with the family and having the family wish that we wouldn't take part in that process of making a decision whether they should be told or not. So it's the other issue that you raised there, and which I think is a good one, is that it is our insurance, but also our whole medical care system is predicated to taking care of illness. And we're starting to see now a trend towards talking about preventative medicine, about maintaining good health, which I think is the real key. Sure, we've got to take care of illness, but there are a lot of things that all of us should be doing towards maintaining our good health that haven't been emphasized to us and talked to us enough about. And so a lot of your newer physicians are being trained in this whole area here.
A question about the American Medical Association. Is its main emphasis also economic, to maintain a certain number of doctors so that every doctor has enough patients?
No.
And to maintain sort of a system of health care where every doctor will prosper?
This is the idea that you get from publicity, but I'm a member of the AMA, although not a real avid supporter of them, because I feel that they've taken a lot of stands on issues in our society, which has left people with the impression that doctors are all concerned just about money and are very heartless people. Let me say that you raised the issue of the number of physicians. The AMA has no say in the number of physicians in our society. The biggest entity that has a say is government, frankly. And if you remember back in the early 1970s when they thought we were going to have a real lack of physicians, and the thing was we're going to train a lot more, and therefore we're going to get more competitive, and therefore we're going to lower the cost. The government put a tremendous emphasis on this, and for instance, the medical school that I attended at that time had 84 students, and a few years after I left, they had doubled the class. The University of Texas had moved in and built a medical school next to ours, and so they had actually quadrupled the number of medical students in the medical center where I did my training at in a very short period of time. Now, Jimmy Carter and his present secretary says doctors create their own market, in a sense, and we don't want to have too many physicians, because then they're going to promote illness among the people and promote expenditure for money. And so they have shut off all of that money this last few years, and now the medical schools are having to cut back. So it's government which really determines what how many physicians are produced, really.
Okay, then the second question is, does AMA try to now change the philosophy toward more health, maintaining health?
Again, it's government that does that. This was an issue which was debated much and talked about much in AMA circles, and because the years passed, it's been promoting specialization. Every doctor takes his little piece and knows all about it, but this is a very costly thing, and we were losing our general practitioners. The government came in, recognized that they felt that the new practice of family medicine or family practice was a concept that we needed in our society, and so they put their money into that area, and that swung all of medicine back the other way. And so now, like for instance, the University of Washington Well, I did a study at Baylor, where I went to school, and 4% of the people that they were at the beginning of the medical school years, if you asked the entering students, what is your interest in medicine? 20% of them said they were interested in family practice or general practice. By the end of the four-year period, only 4% were still interested in that. So they had been exposed to all these specialties, and if you were going to be anything, you had to be a specialist. But if you looked 5 years down the road, after they had graduated, over 25% of them were back to practicing family practice or general practice. Even if they had trained to be a surgeon, they went to a smaller town and they ended up practicing general medicine along with their surgery. So I wrote my thesis around the point that Baylor was missing the point, that they should be training more family physician and putting a bigger emphasis on it. They kind of sniffed at my doctoral thesis. But several years later, I got a call that they wanted to publish my doctoral thesis as part of a grant application for money from the federal government. And now, like the University of Washington, Baylor, about 50% of the people that they turn out are going into family practice and into the general medicine area. So there's been a big swing now again in medicine, and we're trying to turn out this type of physician now. And as part of our concept of family medicine, we practice preventative medicine. We're not as interested in taking care of you when you're sick. We're trying to keep you from getting sick.
I live in a very small community, and our family doctor has a wide, field that he serves. And we've been trying, my husband's on a committee that has been trying to get another doctor there, because we know that our doctor is going to retire. He's 70 or 60, and they've been 3-4 years getting somebody. Finally, now we have somebody to come in. But the pendulum has swung the other way. First it went way this way, and the government had nothing to do with general practitioners. Now it's come back because they realize, and it's a good thing for the small, for these large towns where a doctor works from 8 to 5 or 10 to 7 or whatever it is. That's one thing. But a family doctor in a little town, serving several communities, works many times, 22 hours a day, and nobody can live that way.
That's right. Okay.
I think the AMA is one of the most powerful lobbies in the country and most wealthy lobbies in the country. And I would challenge them to lead rather than follow government directives.
I think a lot of doctors would do the same thing.
Yes. But to be a victim of what the government's whims are is not being the leader that they need to be in looking at what needs are in the country.
Unfortunately, maybe Jim disagrees with me, talking to another physician here, but I feel, and I've been to several conferences where AMA executives have come and supposedly presented the position for American medicine, and I've really been dissatisfied with it. And I think that, unfortunately, the people who are in those kind of positions have been out of practice or have cut their practices way back, and they're pretty far along in their practice years, and I really don't feel that they represent my best interests a lot of the time.
I agree, but the trend toward family practice is only people coming to your first small town and so forth has only been the result of government intervention saying these students are funded through schools, their tuition is paid, and they say your debt payment is to go into this town and practice for X number of years. So it's kind of a cast off either way.
When you're in school, how much of your study is on death? Well, now it's all been on preventative. Lately, it's been preventative, and before that, it was healing. But we're all going to die. That's just when we're born, we're going to die. It seems to me that a lot of training should be had on that. And I guess I've repeated this several times, but I think it's just our attitude, and I think it's the doctor's attitude and my attitude and everybody's, that has got to be re-educated about dying. We're going to. And it seems to me the sooner we're prepared for that, the better off you as a doctor and we as an individual.
I agree with you. And death and dying was not talked about at all when I was in training, and probably there are several courses are dealing with it now.
So it's improving.
Yeah.
I think ministers too have had very little training in the past.
Yeah, ministers are getting the same training, I think, now, probably, aren't they?
We heard that the AMA is a strong lobby, but do you ever have the feeling that before the AMA lobbies, they have already been lobbied to by insurance companies, drug companies, etc., who have influenced the leadership of AMA in terms of shaping their lobby? Do you ever have that feeling that the AMA is really echoing other lobbies, such as drug companies, morticians, etc.?
No, I haven't really had that feeling. I don't know about Jim, but I belong to the American Academy of Family Physicians, which is the organization which speaks for me as a family physician. I'm much more satisfied with their handling of political issues. When they testify before Congress and when they present the issues, the recommendations of our particular specialty of medicine, I'm very satisfied with what they do. And I can't understand how the AMA can get so far out of the swing of things sometimes, away from what our group does.
Tell me the name of your group again.
The American Academy of Family Physicians. AAFP.
How do you define, as a doctor, a term length? We're all on the road to death, and where does terminal come in, is it?
Well, as I said before, we look at the if you're talking about immediacy of being terminal, we're talking about whether you can continue to maintain your vital functions. If we're talking about the long-term aspects, then we're talking about making a diagnosis of an illness for which we know that the treatment is going to be unsuccessful, or for which there's no really treatment except supportive care to be given thereafter.
Along with that, then, is this a one-person decision, or is this kind of a team decision? I think we put a lot of emphasis on a particular doctor being charged, but
usually this kind of a decision is a more than one doctor decision. Whether in terms of for instance cancer, you have the pathologist getting involved in the process and doing the actual reading of the slides and determining exactly what kind of cancer it is. Interpretation of tests involve the pathologist or the radiologist. It's usually a number of doctors that are involved in making this kind of a decision.
What influence do you as enlightened doctors have on the AMA? Now you say you belong to it, but you don't participate in it much. Do they then, when they lobby, count you as one of those who then ostensibly support their position, and is there a way of counterbalancing that?
Well, we have, the AMA is structured very much like our legislatures and all of our administrative things. We have our local representatives that are chosen to go to the state level and to present our concerns and things on the state level, and we have people on the state level who are elected and sent back to the national. And there is a lot of discussion that goes on in the AMA, on both on the state and the national level, on all issues.
Does the AMA take a stand on the importation of foreign doctors?
Yes, I think it has. I couldn't tell you exactly for sure what it is.
Harder, it seems to be overrun by Muslim, Turkish, Iranian doctors, and you can't understand their names, and they have difficulty communicating with you, and the students in our college have difficulty getting into our own med schools.
The thing that bothers me about it is it's the brain drain aspects of it. We're taking the cream of the people from those countries, bring them over here, and polishing off their education, and then keeping them at a considerable savings and cost to us to serve our own people. And meanwhile, their people at home are lacking in these people. That's the thing that really bothers me about it.
They couldn't make the money over there either that they make here.
No, they wouldn't have the standard of living that they have in this country and this kind of thing.
Neither would they have the equipment. I've read the other end of it. We train people so much for the kind of rarefied air of the upper levels of medicine, and when they have to go back to a primitive village and try and practice it, their tools simply are too sharp for dealing with 95% of the people who are sick.
I think though that if they went back, they would be a instrument for change within their own countries to perhaps bring modern medicine to those countries. You know, we're not training them in that large amounts that they would all end up in using skill or losing all the skills that they were trained over here.
I have a question about how serious is the room situation in our medical schools? Is it challenged by all of this importing? Do our young people, our young doctors have an opportunity to get in, or are they squeezed out because of foreigners coming in?
Well, they're not. The foreigners coming in has nothing to do with the number of positions in medical schools.
I see. I didn't know.
But they're very highly sought after.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know why.
Well, there has been cases. There has been cases. Well, you know, they have to put the minorities in, and some of the other kids haven't been able to get into medical school because they filled the slots with minorities.
But if they want to become a physician, they really want to.
Again, the government sets the policy which determines whether the foreign people who come in and receive their training in this country, whether they stay here or not. And that's the, you know, that's the real crux of the matter, is when you come in on a visa for a training for a certain thing, that's supposed to be for a limited period of time. And when your visa runs out, then you're considered an alien. And it's, if these people are able to stay in this country, and continue or stay in this country and practice medicine, they must do it with the grace of the government.
But if somebody foreign does take a spot, there isn't one for an American. At UCLA, there are 200 applicants for every dental opening, for example.
But you don't see people coming in, foreign students, on the first level of medical school. They come in on the graduate level where they're trained to be family physicians or cardiovascular surgeons or neurosurgeons. Okay. And we have an excess of those kind of openings. And especially in the last few years, with the government shifting the trend towards family practice, there are all kinds of slots available for training neurosurgeons and cardiovascular surgeons and these kind of things, you see. And that's where these people come in to take those positions. Marge?
Well, it's a matter of immigration policies.
Right.
That's our immigration policies make it easier for trained except in emergency situations like following the Vietnam War.
When the Arabs were buying Beverly Hills property, no question about their coming in with $3.5-4 million.
Feel free to leave for dinner. I've exhausted the thing. If you want to stay and chat a little bit more, I'm willing to stay and answer questions.